information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Tonight, we care.
Appear to border
and it shows.
The law?
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Across this country, my friends, this is the agenda I have set before my fellow prisoners. Welcome to episode 96 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. It's October 17th, 2008, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority and the Revere Radio Network. Tons to go over this week. We got dummy bombs and collateral news and Acorn and Obama powder and Phil Berg. Palin, Onion Cookies, Ron Paul, Cheney's Heart, Beck, Get Your War On, New JFK Tapes, James Bamford, Corbett Report, Drop Guns, Oliver Stone, and Aldous Huxley. If we can cram all that in, it'll be amazing, my friends. It's episode 96. It's October 17th, 2008, and this is MediaMonarchy.com.
I'm gonna treat you kind. I'm gonna rob you
brand new music from Jenny Lewis and Elvis Costello, two of my favorites. And that track's called Carpetbaggers. It's off her new record, Acid Tongue. And I found that one at the last moment before the show this morning. I always try and find something that's kind of fitting and new and hopefully political. And I pulled that one off. Just like I pulled off the little foam cover on the microphone. And now I feel a little better. I just couldn't feel the microphone. Welcome, my friends, to Media Monarchy, episode 96. It's October 17th, 2008. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you every Friday morning, live at 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and Sunday nights at 7 Eastern Time, revereradionetwork.com. And as always, thanks to KBFR in Boulder and Ground Zero Radio in Atlanta for replaying the show. It means a hell of a lot. And thanks to everybody that hits me up and visits MySpace, Dig, YouTube, Yahoo, IM, and Skype with Media Monarchy as your keyword, and grabbing the podcasts 2 weeks now from iTunes, radioforall.net, and archive.org. I gotta throw one shout-out out. Shout-out loud. And I gotta thank my man, DJ Cliff, who's on before me. He's been on with 3-7 Radio for the last couple months before me here on the Portland Radio Authority. And you can get him on myspace.com/DJ Cliff. That's K-L-Y-P-H. But he's such a cool guy, and he kind of, and I just told him as he was leaving, he kind of puts me in a positive headspace so I don't come in and all, rah, 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 bastards. And we talk about politics and sort it out. So, thanks to him. I've been meaning to do that. And let's look quickly, before we get to our scripted program up on MediaMonarchy.com, we like to take a look sometimes at Google News and see what's breaking on a Friday morning. Four hurt, one sought in blast at a North Georgia law firm. An explosion at a small-town law firm in northern Georgia injured at least four people Friday, and authorities were seeking someone they may believe have been involved in the attack. And it looks like there's an update from MSNBC, suspect held. And so again, an explosion at the Dalton law firm in northern Georgia. So we'll see. And of course, as we scroll down and things that we'll get into, of course, you know, Joe the plumber and Obama and the working class vote and Warren Buffett and GOP suing Acorn for vote fraud. Again, we'll be getting to a bit of that. But let's start it off with a little bit of internet censorship. So this one from Paul Joseph Watson: free nationwide Wi-Fi network to censor political websites. And of course, as usual, it's always being done under the anti-porn pretext. Won't somebody please think of the children? Both individual proposals to roll out free nationwide Wi-Fi internet access across the U.S. contain language indicating that political websites deemed quote-unquote offensive will be filtered out and blocked. The implementation of a universal Wi-Fi network covering the entire country is moving closer following the approval of House Representatives Anna Eshoo, E-S-H-O-O, and Edward Markey after it was discovered the network would not interfere with incumbent wireless telcos such as AT&T and Verizon, who had raised concerns over potential signal interference. Two competing parties, M2Z Networks and the FCC, are jockeying for the rights to roll out the network, but both have already stated their intent to install filters that block out pornography and anything else deemed quote-unquote harmful. So, according to a report over on DailyTech.com, quote, both proposals stipulate that any free wireless offerings have mandatory content filters preventing users from viewing any material that would be harmful to teens and adolescents, including pornography and anything contemporary community standards deem as obscene. Free speech advocates call this condition unconstitutional. And so back to Paul Joseph Watson, as they've all previously reported with the link for you. Similar free Wi-Fi networks on smaller scales include mandatory content filters that screen out even mildly political websites that are not part of the corporate establishment media. And actually, Nathan guy that follows me on the Portland Radio Authority, said he was checking out or trying to check out the page. I forget if he said if it was at PCC or PSU, Portland State University or Portland Community College, and he said the page was kind of jacked up and he wasn't able to access it, and he was wondering if it was perhaps blocked, but I have no evidence for that. But let's jump and shift gears, as we'll be doing a lot on this episode. As I told you last week, I finally got out of my overnight graveyard shift, which I've been doing basically 2 years for the complete life of this radio show. So now, all of a sudden, I'm not working 11 p.m. to 7:30 a.m., and so my schedule's all kind of out of whack. I'm trying to figure out exactly the best way to post and edit and do media monarchy the way I have been doing, so bear with me. So, again, we're going to breakneck all over the place and hit tons of news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. So, let's jump to Raw Replay and KVBC News 3. A dummy bomb falls from a jet in Nevada.
Strange story out of Nellis Air Force Base today. The base officials have some explaining to do this afternoon. As Anita Roman reports, a dummy bomb fell off one of their jets and hit a truck down below.
Shortly after 11:30 this morning, Nellis Security Forces and Las Vegas Metropolitan Police responded to report of an object falling from the sky.
Officials from Nellis Air Force Base can tell us what fell out of the sky.
This is a two-piece weapon.
But they still don't know why the bomb dummy device, or BDU, fell off a plane and landed on this truck as it was driving down Las Vegas Boulevard near Beasley Avenue.
These are loaded on various types of release devices. Most of them are a sort of a pod-shaped device. Something went wrong here.
The BDU-33 is a 25-pound device that is regularly used to simulate the ballistics of real air-to-ground weapons. This training device does not carry explosives, but it does carry a small smoke charge, which is used to mark its impact point. Officials say the plane it fell from was approximately 1,700 feet in the air, that the BDU first fell onto Nellis Air Force Base.
And it bounced, I'm guessing, 700 to 800 feet. Simply because of the distance it had fallen from the sky, it hit close to one of our large mobility warehouses and then bounced across Las Vegas Boulevard and made impact with the truck.
According to Air Force Base officials, 75% of all weapons, some similar to this one, dropped out of airplanes are dropped over the Nevada testing training range north of Las Vegas.
Whether it's an accident or negligence, or otherwise, it still accomplishes the unseen mission of acclimating you to the military in the homeland. And of course, this isn't the first time this year that we've reported on something like this. If we jump back and hit the flashback button to March of this year, we reported on MediaMonarchy.com that a practice bomb hit an Oklahoma apartment. But let's shift gears yet again to the latest episode of Collateral News. High noon in Cook County. A sheriff's office in Cook County, Illinois, has refused to execute foreclosure orders indefinitely. And you can hit up the AP article to read more about that. Know where he got the idea? From citizens in his jurisdiction. Could it be a trend that spreads?
What if they gave a foreclosure but nobody came to enforce it? When a sheriff who's not exactly a champion of civil rights refuses to foreclose homes, then you know the times are a-changing. It's a clear reminder that a just showing of civil unrest can work. Welcome to Collateral.
The noonday train will bring Frank Miller. If I'm a man, I must be brave.
In early October, Cook County, Illinois Sheriff Tom Dart announced that his office would no longer remove anyone from a foreclosed property. Dart complained that many local residents, including a number of renters who were fully up to date on their rental payments, were ordered forcibly removed from their homes without any immediate recourse and without the 90-day notification required by law. Here's a quote from Sheriff Dart. Just in the past month, about a third of the people we were asked to evict were under questionable circumstances. It got to the point that enough was enough. End quote. Dart's office was alerted to the illegalities of the mortgage companies by citizen activists in Cook County. Dare I say it, community organizers. The sheriff heard their pleas and demanded that mortgage companies give 120 days notice to residents before anyone could be evicted. Now, if a sheriff like Tom Dart, a conservator of the peace, the highest ranking law enforcement official in the county, and one in this case with a history of unfairness towards blacks and Latinos, if that man refuses to act on foreclosure notices, you know these are special times. Seize the day. Let your sheriff know about Sheriff Dart. And remember, without muscle on the ground, financial elites are powerless to have their bidding done. Alternatively, we can sit on our asses, continue on this course, and watch as Washington earmarks trillions more taxpayer dollars to bail out other failing entities. All the while, of course, they cry poor now when government is asked to provide vital services for ordinary people. It's almost high noon. If you find Dart's actions important, then spread the word. Send emails to your local authorities. Press your congressmen to write legislation protecting people in their homes until a fairer resolution to this mess is enacted. You see, with the economic crisis here to stay, now will come the populist appeals. We shouldn't let those who are making appeals to the people merely for political gain, however, off the hook. Take them back to work. Hope to see you next week.
Miller!
That was the latest episode of Collateral News, High Noon in Cook County. I love Collateral News. I wish they'd work on their audio a little bit. I didn't even add anything to that, the little music underbeds that I like to add, because it usually fucks it up, and with that one it was hard enough to hear anyway without their music bed. But anyway, collateralnews.tv. And speaking of community organizers, let's jump to the latest on presidential selection 08. Kang or Kodos, douchebag or turd sandwich, which one will it be? But we're going to go over Botox, Weatherman, prisoners in powder, and tons more. But first, Joe the plumber. More like Joe the Keating family operative. This from Crooks and Liars. I guess it's no wonder John McCain was so happy to use Joe the plumber as a debate prop. He's a partisan Republican who also happens to be a member of McCain's old friends, the Keating family. So, this from Martin Eisenstadt. Turns out that Joe Wurzelbacher from the Toledo event is a close relative of Robert Wurzelbacher of Milford, Ohio. Who's Robert Wurzelbacher? Only Charles Keating's son-in-law and the former senior vice president of American Continental, the parent company of the infamous Lincoln Savings and Loan. The new retired elder Wurzelbacher is also a major contributor to Republican causes, giving well over $10,000 in the last few years. Now, I guess we know why Joe is telling the press that Obama is a socialist and that the Obama tax plan infuriated him. After all, it would hit families like the Keatings and their minions the hardest. Not to mention that Obama's economic blah-bitty-blah is supposedly going to put the crimp on the big money banksters like the Keating Five. Bullshit. We, of course, know that Barack Obama is a Goldman Sachs frontman. Go to opensecrets.org and look at Barack Obama's largest campaign contributor, Goldman Sachs. Have you heard much about them lately? In other fraudulent vote news, U.S. officials may have uncovered attempted voter fraud less than a month before the U.S. election. This from Sky News, Rupert Murdoch. 11 separate investigations have now been launched into a voter registration group called the Association of Community Organizations for Reform, or ACORN, for Reform Now. The authorities believe they may have duplicated voter forms, employed convicts to register people, and even stolen the names of the American football team, the Dallas Cowboys, in order to create fake voters. The suspicions started when authorities in Las Vegas raided the organization's office, removing 8 computer hard drives and several boxes of documents. ACORN called the raid, quote, a stunt that serves no useful purpose other than to discredit our work. They suggested the investigations into them were politically motivated, but the concerns about dodgy election papers started to spread to other states. Authorities in Indiana said they had concerns about roughly 1,000 voters registered by the group there, and Fox News reporters in the state of Missouri found 10 registration documents with the same name and signature. Acorn has registered up to 1.3 million voters across the U.S. so far.
Amid the raucous back and forth of the final presidential debate, this charge from Republican John McCain.
We need to know the full extent of Senator Obama's relationship with Acorn, who is now on the verge of maybe perpetrating one of the greatest frauds in voter history in this country, maybe destroying the fabric of democracy.
In Nevada, the voter fraud team raided Acorn's office. It's one of at least 8 states that have begun voter fraud investigations. Acorn says it's registered more than 1 million young people, minorities, and poor and working class voters. But Acorn has come under fire for submitting registrations with fake names or other falsified information.
Had nothing to do with us. We were not involved. The only involvement I've had with Acorn was I represented them alongside the U.S. Justice Department in making Illinois implement a motor voter law that helped people get registered at DMVs.
Acorn officials defend the group's actions and blame a few bad apples for bogus registration.
Out of 13,000 workers, there were inevitably a few who decided they tried to pad their hours by duplicating a card and filling out another one or making up a name. If we discovered this and through our calls or looking at the cards, we'd not only turn that information over, but turn the information that we had about that former employee, because they'd been fired by that point, to elections officials and ask for their help in prosecuting that person.
Your manual says one thing, yet you've done another.
Cuyahoga County, Ohio, the Board of Elections grilled Acorn officials. They even heard about one man who filled out 73 voter registration cards in a 5-month period.
There's a problem. What should this board do to solve that problem?
House Republicans have renewed their push for a Justice Department investigation of Acorn. 6 GOP leaders urged the Attorney General to make sure ballots by ineligible or fraudulent voters are not counted on Election Day. Matt Friedman, The Associated Press.
If we look over to Google News right now on this Friday morning, October 17th, Pennsylvania GOP sues Acorn and state for alleged voter fraud. That's from the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Associated Press. U.S. investigators look into voter fraud allegations. That's from Voice of America. And Republicans and Acorn battle over PA registration drive from the Pittsburgh Post-Herald. And as I look just to the left of it, on a different note, Germany has just passed a $675 billion bank bailout. Everybody's getting into the act in the new economic world order. But let's jump to suspicious packages. White powder causes evacuation of Obama office. Did they go to the back of a limousine with Larry Sinclair? I don't know.
Tonight, a scare at the South Philadelphia campaign office of Senator Barack Obama. It was filled with volunteers when it was evacuated because of a suspicious letter. Sharon Crowley live tonight at 15th and Christian with the story. Sharon.
Yeah, that's right. A volunteer brought in the mail and said that one of the letters seemed to be suspicious in nature. They brought it outside, called police. Now, luckily, after an investigation, it determined that the substance in the letter was harmless, but there still was a threatening letter, so that investigation continues tonight. The hazmat unit carefully removes a suspicious letter found outside the South Philadelphia campaign office of Democratic presidential nominee Senator Barack Obama. Philadelphia police fire hazmat teams, the Secret Service, FBI, and the U.S. Postal Service police responded to 15th and Christian, the campaign offices here, after a volunteer opened a letter and found a substance and a threatening note. Staffers placed the letter outside the building and called police.
The letter was somewhat threatening in nature, and it contained a substance that we believe to be a hazmat.
Examining the letter, investigators determined the substance was just harmless sugar. But the note sent through the U.S. mail and addressed to Obama headquarters here had a threatening letter. So the investigation into this incident continues tonight.
We want to look over the letter through the plastic bag that we have it in to see what's actually being stated in the letter to the best of our knowledge, and then determine the source of who's going to be investigating that situation.
A spokesperson for the Obama campaign here in Philadelphia did not want to talk on camera about the incident, only to say volunteers acted appropriately and that they are grateful for the Philadelphia Police Department's quick response. And federal agencies, of course, will be trying to figure out exactly where that letter was mailed from and, of course, who mailed it. Now, as for Senator Barack Obama, he's not on the campaign trail today. He is preparing for tomorrow night's debate. Live in South Philadelphia, I'm Sharon Crowley, Fox 29 News.
Brown sugar. How come you taste so good? Let's jump to the Washington Times and learn about how Joseph Biden routes his campaign cash to his family and their firms. Democratic vice presidential candidate Senator Joseph Biden Jr. has paid more than $2 million in campaign cash to his family members, their businesses, and employers over the years, a practice that watchdogs criticize as rife with potential conflicts of interest. The money largely flowed from the coffers of Mr. Biden's failed presidential campaign during the past 2 years to a company that employs his sister and longtime campaign manager, Valerie Biden Owens, according to campaign disclosure filings. The senator from Delaware also directed campaign legal work to a Washington lobbying and law firm founded by his son, R. Hunter Biden. And if we jump to thinkprogress.org, Barack Obama appears on hundreds of absentee ballots in New York. The Albany Times Union reports that Senator Barack Obama's last name is spelled Osama on hundreds of absentee ballots mailed out this week to voters in Rensselaer County, New York. I may be saying that wrong. Both Democratic and Republican county election officials insist the error was an honest mistake and a typo, but the paper notes that the letters S and B are not exactly keyboard neighbors. During the Democratic primary, Obama's first name was misspelled on approximately 2,000 absentee ballots in Florida. But again, more on Joe Biden. This from the Washington Post. Biden's Botox. Joe Biden looks different. Something about his eyes, which seem smaller, and his forehead, which seems smoother. Compared with images from last year, he seems better rested, yet also strangely a little sleepier. Karen Bradley, a University of Maryland professor who studies politicians' body movement and what it conveys to voters, says it's, quote, a little strange that nothing moves from his eyes on up. Since she otherwise finds Biden a compelling communicator who powerfully telegraphs his conviction on a topic via other body language. Mary Cohen, a Rockville plastic surgeon, is more blunt. He clearly has had Botox. The doctor, a Republican, told us. The lines are gone on his forehead. There's no way makeup or surgery could do that. Vain, effeminate males. Let's get a little dirtier now. I know you won't like this. This is coming from bloggernews.net. Obama joined Socialist Third Party in the 90s. Democratic candidate Barack Obama was a member of the Socialist New Party during the 1990s. And you can click a link to discoverthenetworks.org and learn more. According to new evidence unearthed by web bloggers receiving the party's endorsement for his state Senate run in 1996, reports earlier this summer that Obama was associated with the new party were vigorously denied by the Obama campaign and the new party, but researchers examining internet archives have found new party documents clearly indicating Obama was a member of the party, link to populist.com. And they received its endorsement, encouraged party members to work with him in the Illinois State House, and signed a contract agreeing to maintain a relationship with the Marxist-led party during his Senate term. The new party was active in the United States from 92 to 98 and was strongly affiliated with the Marxist and socialist organizations, including the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA. And if we hit up now a few from a man, James, at total411.info, Obama files to delay discovery in citizenship challenge. So with a link for you to the PDF, here is the full motion PDF filed by Obama in the DNC. And here's a link and a quote from the press release at Philip J. Berg's ObamaCrimes.com website, and we're going to hear from him in just a second, but from the press release. Philip J. Berg, Esquire, the attorney who filed suit against Barack H. Obama challenging Senator Obama's lack of qualifications to serve as President of the United States, announced that Obama and the DNC filed a joint motion for protective order to stay discovery pending a decision on the motion to dismiss. And that was filed on September 24th. While legal, Berg stated he is outraged as this is another attempt to hide the truth from the public. It is obvious that the documents do not exist to prove that Obama is qualified to be president.
There is a federal lawsuit against Democratic presidential nominee Barack Obama. It claims the candidate is not a natural-born citizen of the United States and therefore is ineligible to run for president under the U.S. Constitution. A University of Toledo law graduate is responsible for filing this lawsuit. Fox Toledo's Christy Lee spoke with him, and she's live now with the very latest. Christy.
Philip J. Berg tells me since filing this federal lawsuit against Obama in late August, there has been a motion to dismiss the case and a protective order to keep Obama's records private. These motions haven't been decided yet, but Berg is prepared to take the case all the way to the Supreme Court. Berg is a lifelong Democrat, so why is he fighting his own ticket? He told me that and more from his office in Pennsylvania.
If we can't enforce our Constitution, especially a candidate for president, we're in real trouble in this country. More trouble than you really want to believe, and it's frightening.
Three qualifications must be met for someone to become president under the U.S. Constitution. At least 35 years of age, a resident of the U.S. for 14 years, and a natural-born citizen. Berg believes Barack Obama does not meet the last qualification. He believes Obama was born in Kenya, and that further investigation revealed he may still be a citizen of Indonesia. Here's a school registration Berg has obtained listing Obama's name as Barry Satoro, after his Indonesian stepfather Lolo Satoro, and lists his citizenship as Indonesia. Berg says Obama's mother sent him back to the U.S. when he was 10 years old, and one of two things would have happened then. If he went through immigration, he would be a naturalized citizen, not a natural-born citizen. If he did not go through immigration,
he today would still be a citizen of Indonesia, and he could be considered an illegal alien, which would mean that he cannot even hold his Senate seat from Illinois. So it's really important that we all look at his records.
FactCheck.org claims it has proof of Obama's U.S. citizenship. Berg questions that proof because the website is owned by Annenberg.
That is the group where Obama sat on the board of for a number of years disbursing funds. So I would think there's a little conflict of interest there and a little bias on their part.
He says proof needs to be in the hands of a judge.
Senator Obama, if I'm wrong, prove me wrong, produce the documentation. If you have nothing to hide, stop hiding behind legalism. Let's avoid a constitutional crisis in this country.
Ron Rothenbuehler, chairman of the Lucas County Democratic Party, says he didn't know anything about the lawsuit against Obama, but questions Berg's intentions.
If it's not a vendetta, then it must be somebody challenging somebody's right to either privacy or the questioning the information they've already received.
Berg's website chronicling its lawsuit against Obama has received more than 32 million hits since he launched it in late August. We will have a link to that website and more of my interview with Berg on myfoxtoledo.com. Reporting live, Christy Lee, Fox Toledo News, First at 4.
And again, the website is obamacrimes.com. So I think it breaks down basically like this. If he was born in Kenya, he's not a natural-born citizen. If he was born in Hawaii, they moved to Indonesia, and Indonesia did not and does not have dual citizenship. And again, it's the foundations behind factcheck.org and Annenberg Challenge. And what brings us to a piece from WorldNet Daily, and we're going to wrap all this up. I'm going to put it into perspective. Don't freak out. Did William Ayers ghostwrite Obama's book? Prior to 1990, when Obama was contracted to write Dreams from My Father, he had written very close to nothing. As an undergrad, Obama had written what he justifiably calls, quote, very bad poetry. He published nothing under his own name in the Harvard Law Review, where he served as an editor and as president. After leaving Harvard, he published nothing in its review or any law journal. Then in 1995, this untested 33-year-old produced what Time magazine has called, with a straight face, the best written memoir ever produced by an American politician. The public is asked to believe Obama wrote this on his own. I do not buy this canard for a minute, not at all. In writing a book on intellectual fraud, Hoodwinked, with a link for you, and the author Jack Cashill, Cashill.com, I developed an eye for literary humbug, and Dreams serves up an eyeful. And then finally, again, from total411.info, an interesting compare, contrast, juxtaposition of the Obama and Weatherman logo. The Obama campaign has taken to designing differentiated versions of its logo for different identity groups. One website, Logobama, even offers up the chance to design your own Obama logo. Some have commented on the similarity between the logo for the terrorist group, the Weathermen, co-founded by Obama's friend Bill Ayers, to the logo for the Obama campaign. We at Total411.info have used the good offices of LogoBama.com to create what is posted up for you on MediaMonarchy.com. The following Obama Weatherman hybrid logo, so all the Weatherman supporters of Obama can show their pride. Also, check out the unadulterated Obama logo and the Weatherman logo as it appears on the cover of Ayers' book for comparison purposes. And again, those are all posted up, and the logos do kind of look similar. With, of course, you can always break down any sort of sacred symbolism in our logos and media, the rising sun and all that. But again, I don't spend a whole bunch of time, even though they're fascinating and important and interesting questions, about Obama's citizenship or his connection to Bill Ayers. But again, we do know that it's all foundation funded. And again, we've pointed out that a lot of the weathermen getting foundation money, acting like they were doing something the man didn't know about. I'm going to take the man's money and blow shit up. Bullshit. They know it. We went over that last week. So we don't even have to get into any some of the more speculative things, even though they're probably not. Again, whether it's right or heirs or citizenship or Sinclair or God knows what, all you do have to look at is, again, like I said, Goldman Sachs. Zbigniew Brzezinski as his chief foreign policy advisor. A skull and bones guy as his chief financial advisor. And again, it's just two puppets battling it out for the management position of Slavery Incorporated. So let's switch to Turd Sandwich. McCain addresses crowd. This one's so fucked up and sad and scary. McCain addresses the crowd as, "My fellow prisoners,
Across this country, this is the agenda I have set before my fellow prisoners, and the same standards of clarity and candor must now be applied to my opponent."
Did you get that? Let's listen to that again.
Across this country, this is the agenda I have set before my fellow prisoners, and the same standards of clarity and candor must now be applied to my opponent.
So that's at least funny and disturbing on three levels. One, it's funny because it's funny when politicians say dumb shit, or anyone on the public stage. Two, it's scary because holy fuck, dude, are you having some kind of flashback that you're talking to your POWs before you went and stayed in the Hanoi Hilton, or what the fuck? And the third one is that he's basically laying it out and saying, "What's up, bitches? We're all prisoners here. You gotta vote for one of us."
"Well, I think I'll vote for a third party." "Go ahead. Throw your vote away. Ha, ha, ha."
There's a video I'm not going to play a clip from where Olbermann slams McCain's connections to bona fide eugenicists, racists, and fascists. Partisan Keith Olbermann argues that if Obama is attacked for his connections to Wright and Ayers, then the corrupt connections of McCain, including bona fide racists, fascists, and eugenicists, also deserve to come under fire. So in the clip, Olbermann names the U.S. Council for World Freedom and a number of controversial fellow board members connected to McCain. And of course, we went over, I believe, last week, the U.S. Council for World Freedom and its connections to, of course, right-wing death squads in Latin America and Iran-Contra and John Singlaub. If we return to thinkprogress.org, this is one that I've meant to hit because it, of course, fits perfectly into media monarchy. And it's happened many, many, many other times, and I think you can probably click through and find the whole list, but let's just hit one of them. Foo Fighters demands McCain stop using their music. Throughout the campaign season, Senator John McCain's presidential campaign has continually drawn the ire of musicians by using their copywritten material without permission. Now, yet another band is complaining. And you can read also, I think, about Bon Jovi and John Cougar Mellencamp. And so the Foo Fighters issued a statement telling McCain to stop using their song, My Hero. The saddest thing about this is that My Hero was written as a celebration of the common man and his extraordinary potential, the band said in a statement. To have it appropriated without our knowledge and used in a manner that perverts the original sentiment of the lyric just tarnishes the song. And then they ran off and recorded exclusive Walmart material. As Think Progress has previously noted, McCain's continual copyright infringement contradicts his campaign pledge to protect copyrighted works, with the link for you to johnmccain.com. And there have been other things that tie in with YouTube and digital millennium copyright act violations and all kinds of shit. But if we jump back to the Associated Press, and again, there's all the little nooks and crannies of all these stories. Sometimes they're not really worth delving into fully, so we'll just cover it quite quickly. Palin abused power in Troopergate firing. Sarah Palin unlawfully abused her power as governor by trying to have her former brother-in-law fired as state trooper, the chief investigator of an Alaska legislative panel concluded last Friday. The politically charged inquiry imperiled her reputation as a reformer on John McCain's Republican ticket. Investigator Stephen Branchflower, in a report to a bipartisan panel that looked into the matter, found Palin in violation of state ethics laws that prohibits public officials from using their office for personal gains.
She hits the campaign trail. A legislative report says Governor Sarah Palin abused her power when she tried to get her former brother-in-law fired as an Alaska state trooper. CBS 2 political reporter Dave Bryan joins us now with more on tonight's report and some booze for John McCain. Dave.
Paul, the booze came when McCain tried to settle down a volatile crowd outraged against Barack Obama. But tonight, the Troopergate report, written by the chief investigator of a bipartisan Alaska legislative committee, may cause some ripples on the campaign trail. The chief investigator for an Alaskan legislative committee concludes Governor Sarah Palin violated a state ethics law that prohibits state officials from using their office for personal gain. The inquiry looked into Palin's firing of Alaskan Public Safety Commissioner Walter Monaghan. He says he was canned because he resisted pressure to fire her former brother-in-law, who was involved in a bitter divorce battle with Palin's sister.
Absolutely no pressure ever put on Commissioner Monaghan to hire or fire anybody at any time.
But the legislature's investigative report finds that Palin let a family grudge influence her decision-making, even if it wasn't the only reason Monaghan was dismissed. The release of the Troopergate report comes on an especially stormy campaign day.
I can't trust Obama. I have read about him, and he's Arab.
With crowds at GOP campaign events seemingly growing angrier and more frustrated by the day, John McCain himself was booed by his own supporters at an event in Minnesota when he tried to lower the temperature a bit when asked about Barack Obama.
But I have to tell you, he is a decent person and a person that you do not have to be scared as President of the United States.
Now, a final word on tonight's Troopergate report. It says there were a few cases where Governor Palin herself got involved, but for the most part, it was her husband, Todd, who led the campaign to get Trooper Mike Wooten fired. Dave Bryan, CBS 2 News.
Oh, Palin. And as we've, I believe, commented before with the appropriate song from Ben Folds 5, your redneck past. Again, so much of this shit would be downright hilarious if we weren't in such fucking dire situation. Yes, it would be funny to laugh at this ridiculously unqualified dumbass from Alaska. Now, I realized I missed one that I wanted to hit on the Obama saga, but let's hit the latest from the Onion News Network. Precocious youngster sells cookies to buy an attack ad.
This election year, America's youth are getting more involved in politics than ever, even if they're too young to vote. Jean Ann Warden takes us beyond facts. Anderson is just 8 years old, but she's already taking part in the political process, helping her favorite candidate, Barack Obama.
McCain is a liar, so buy my cookies. McCain.
Without any help from her parents, Emily has raised enough money from selling cookies and lemonade to buy airtime for this political attack ad against John McCain.
John McCain says he believes in family values, but evidence links him to several mistresses throughout his time in the Senate. His wife stole prescription pills to support her drug habit. John McCain, philanderer, thief lover, wrong for America.
Paid for by Emily Anderson.
Emily says the ad is her way of being a part of grown-up politics.
Why did you decide to make this ad?
I want to tear down Senator McCain so he can't win.
I don't know where she gets it from because my husband and I were not really very political.
Often working from the end of the school day until her 8 p.m. bedtime, Emily designed the ad all by herself. It's all part of this little girl's big plan to erode McCain's base of support by any means necessary.
John McCain is unfit to lead. He should be put out to pasture.
So far, the ad appears to be working. In areas where it has run, McCain's favorable ratings have dropped as much as 5 points.
You can make a lie sound like the truth if you say it over and over and over again. The key is to control the public dialogue.
Emily's actions recently drew the ire of the McCain camp, who called her tactics, quote, gutter politics. Despite the senator's mean words, Emily hasn't lost her focus.
Did you know, while he was a POW, he tried to commit suicide twice? This man should not be president.
She's amazing.
Will all of this work? We'll have to wait until November to see. But in the meantime, Emily will keep on working to make sure people come to hate John McCain as much as she does. From Beyond the Facts, I'm Jean Ann Wharton.
I'm sure we'll be seeing horrible things from that little girl in the future. Moving on, an endorsement from Rachel Ray proves frighteningly important for the Obama campaign.
I'm sure we'll be seeing horrible things from that little girl in the future. And remember, you know, if you repeat a lie enough, it'll start to sound like the truth. So let's hit the one last big article that I almost forgot, but it's important. It's an op-ed from the Washington Times, but it sounds like it could have come from Paul Joseph Watson or Kurt Nimmo or someone else. The coming liberal thugocracy. I need you to go out and talk to your friends and talk to your neighbors, Barack Obama told a crowd in Elko, Nevada. I want you to talk to them whether they're independent or whether they're Republican. I want you to argue with them and get in their face. Actually, Obama supporters are doing a lot more than getting into people's faces. They seem determined to shut people up. That's what Obama supporters alerted by campaign emails did when conservative Stanley Kurtz appeared on Milton Rosenberg's WGN radio show in Chicago. Mr. Kurtz had been researching Mr. Obama's relationship with unrepentant Weather Underground terrorist William Ayers in the Chicago Annenberg Challenge papers in the Richard J. Daley Library in Chicago, papers that were closed off to him for some days, apparently at the behest of Obama supporters. Obama fans, Kool-Aid drinkers, jammed WGN's phone lines and sent in hundreds of protest emails. The message was clear to anyone who would follow Mr. Rosenberg's example. We will make trouble for you if you let anyone make the case against the one. Other Obama supporters have threatened critics with criminal prosecution. And remember, we just went over this in Missouri. Of course, the governor issued a statement decrying the police state tactics. In September, St. Louis County Circuit Attorney Bob McCullough and St. Louis City Circuit Attorney Jennifer Joyce warned citizens that they would bring criminal libel prosecutions against anyone who made statements against Mr. Obama that were false. I'd been under the impression that the Alien and Sedition Acts had long gone out of existence in 1801. Not so, apparently, in metropolitan St. Louis. Similarly, the Obama campaign called for criminal investigation of the American Issues Project when it ran ads highlighting Mr. Obama's ties to Mr. Ayers. These attempts to shut down political speech have become routine for liberals. Congressional Democrats sought to reimpose the Fairness Doctrine on broadcasters, with a link for you to read about the Fairness Doctrine, which, until it was repealed in the 1980s, required equal time for different points of view. The motive was plain: to shut down the one conservative-leaning communications medium, talk radio. Liberal talk show hosts have mostly failed to draw audiences, and many liberals can't abide having citizens hear contrary views. To their credit, some liberal old-timers, like House Appropriations Chairman David Obey, voted against the Fairness Doctrine in line with their long-standing support of free speech. But you can expect the Fairness Doctrine to get another vote if Obama wins and Democrats increase their congressional majorities.
corporate liberals have done their share in shutting down anti-liberal speech, too. With the link, again, to opensecrets.org, speaking of corporate liberals. Saturday Night Live ran a spoof of the financial crisis that skewered Democrats like House Financial Services Chairman Barney Frank and liberal contributors Herbert and Marion Sandler, who sold toxic waste-filled Golden West to Wachovia Bank for $24 billion. Kind of surprising, but not for long. The tape of the broadcast disappeared from NBC's website and was replaced with another that omitted the references to Mr. Frank and the Sandlers. Evidently, NBC and its parent, General Electric, don't want people to hear speech that attacks liberals. Then there's the Democrats' card check legislation that would abolish secret ballot elections in determining whether employees are represented by unions. The union's strategy is obvious. Send a few thugs over to employees' homes, we know where you live, and get them to sign cards that will trigger a union victory without giving employers the chance to be heard. Once upon a time, liberals prided themselves with considerable reason as the staunchest defenders of free speech. Union organizers in the 30s and 40s made the case that they should have access to employers, or rather employees, to speak freely to them, and union leaders like George Meany and Walter Reuther were ardent defenders of the First Amendment. That was then. Today's liberals seem to be taking their marching orders from other quarters. Specifically from the college and university campuses where administrators armed with speech codes have for years been disciplining and subjecting to sensitivity training any students who dare utter thoughts that liberals find offensive. The campuses that once prided themselves as zones of free expression are now the least free part of the society. Obama supporters who found the campuses congenial and Mr. Obama himself, who has chosen to live all his adult life in university communities, seem to find it entirely natural to suppress speech they don't like and seem utterly oblivious to claims this violates the letter and spirit of the First Amendment. In this campaign, we have seen the coming of the Obama thugocracy, suppressing free speech, and we may see its flourishing in the 4 or 8 years ahead. Now, again, that's a super conservative op-ed on Washington Times that does have a lot of the college lefty blah, blah, blah bullshit to it. However, again, it raises important points and things that we've pointed out before, like the Fairness Doctrine or the Missouri Truth Squads. And again, I wonder where they got that name from. So, let's put this into perspective, my friends. By jumping across, way across the pond to Russia Today. I've become more and more a fan of their news and their YouTube channel. Much thanks to stories like this. Ron Paul, the only true voice amid growing crisis.
Preparing for the worst is being fed promises from all sides. The U.S. president delivers daily affirmations on the crippled economy, while those who hope to succeed him in office charge that only they know how to lift America off its knees. Some of the public is transferring trust to former presidential candidate Ron Paul. Amid cash worries, hundreds pay $25 to hear Paul speak at the University of Maryland.
The deficit has skyrocketed. We have invaded people's privacy. We've expanded the war. We're all over the world.
The U.S. congressman voted twice against the $700 billion bailout plan the majority of Americans oppose. He believes the economy has to tank naturally in order to rebound quicker. Otherwise, he says, pain will be prolonged. In the meantime,
and save money and don't waste money. Don't borrow money. Don't buy a fancy car and a fancy house when you don't have the money to do it.
The people in these stands are not cheering for us, supporting us like they normally do. Instead, they're here objecting to the game they say the U.S. government is playing with the economy.
Many students are in panic mode about their great future being trampled on by a Great Depression.
It's really, frankly, terrifying that I'm going into a job market with all this inflation, and jobs are disappearing.
I'm frightened, actually. I'm very scared at our current economic status.
1 month into her first year at university, Amanda Pelletier is getting a part-time job to help her parents pay a $45,000 college loan.
We're not seeing any payout from, you know, large taxes, and I feel like Dr. Paul's message is one of the only ones that makes sense.
Paul's platform of free market, less government, and non-intervention foreign policy continues to gain momentum among the electorate. During his campaign, a Republican broke fundraising records and received more contributions from members of the armed forces than any other candidate.
Just tell the truth. He's been telling the truth his whole life.
But the truth in this situation hurts. Unemployment, home foreclosures, and inflation. So much for the talking. Hundreds of millions are waiting for action. Marina Hortnaya, RT.
Ron Paul, campaignforliberty.com. Ron Paul still gets my vote. Let's jump now to the Associated Press. U.S. and Iraq agree to pact for withdrawal in 2011. In other news, I have a bridge that you can purchase. Washington and Baghdad have reached a final agreement after months of talks on a pact that would require U.S. forces to withdraw from Iraq by 2011, U.S. and Iraqi officials said on Wednesday. The bilateral pact replaces a U.N. Security Council resolution enacted after the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and will give Iraq's elected government authority over the U.S. troop presence for the first time. Iraq said it had secured the right to prosecute U.S. soldiers for serious crimes under certain circumstances, an issue both sides have long said was holding up the pact. The agreement was submitted to Iraqi political leaders for approval, a first step toward ratifying it in the Iraqi parliament. Iraqi government spokesman Ali al-Dabagh said, in public, U.S. officials were subdued. State Department spokesman Sean McCormick said, quote, nothing is done until everything is done. Everything isn't done. The Iraqis are still talking among themselves. We are still talking to the Iraqis. Now, we're well into halfway through October, and I don't believe we've seen our October surprise. But talk about a pleasant October surprise. But he's gonna, of course, be okay. Darth Cheney soldiers on. But a couple of mornings ago, I was surprised, or although not really surprised, but kind of in a fucked up way, hopeful and happy. Cheney was experiencing an abnormal heart rhythm. And you can insert Cheney heart joke here.
Vice President Dick Cheney waves to the cameras as he's taken to George Washington University Hospital in Washington. Then he went to the hospital after suffering an abnormal heart rhythm Wednesday morning. The condition is called atrial fibrillation.
The upper chambers of the heart in him right now, rather than contracting regularly and effectively to move blood, are quivering like a bag of worms.
Cheney saw a White House doctor after experiencing a problem.
The Vice President's going to be fine. I talked to him this morning. Thank you for asking. He was at our briefings this morning. He came in and told me he's going to head back into the hospital to have his heart check worked on.
The 67-year-old underwent a routine procedure to shock his heart back to a normal rhythm.
Well, the vast, vast majority of patients go in, get the procedure, and are back at work the very same afternoon.
This is the second time in less than a year that Cheney has had the same procedure.
No reason to worry, because that's what's expected. It's the rule rather than the exception that someone such as Vice President Cheney, with a history of heart disease, will have atrial fibrillation, and that atrial fibrillation will be coming back.
Cheney has had four heart attacks since he was 37 years old. In 2001, he had a special pacemaker implanted in his chest. After Wednesday's treatment, Cheney smiled and waved to cameras before he left the hospital. Matt Friedman, The Associated Press.
MSNBC notes that Cheney, 66, has a history of heart problems, including four heart attacks, quadruple bypass surgery, two artery-clearing angioplasties, and an operation to implant a defibrillator 6 months ago. In July 2007, he had surgery to replace the defibrillator that monitors his heartbeat. According to the Chicago Tribune, Cheney was slated to attend a private, closed-to-the-media fundraiser at Marty Ozinga's house in Illinois.
Lots of crime family action happening in Chicago lately. Chicago kind of reasserting itself on the national stage of organized crime. Welcome back. My friends, we're now about to knock on hour two. And I suppose it's appropriate because the computer just crashed. Or I kicked it. God damn it. Let's take a little, we're going to take a little technical difficulties break.
You can make a difference. You just have to find the grip. You don't live in a free country. You got the flag on your shirt there. Oh, it's upside down. You're fucking sweet. It's not a free country. You're born free. I mean, you're born absolutely free, except for laws of nature. Those, if you drink, you get drunk. That's a law. If you get old, you die. That's a law, too. If you sit on a tack, you will bleed from the ass. These are the only laws that you're born with, and any government just fucks you out of that type of freedom. If you really think you're free tonight, you, hero, Officer Bomb, you're a free man. You live in a free country. But you're just, you go upstairs, you take your own beer, you risk your life for. You sit on the hood of your monster truck in the parking lot, drink your beer, and see how long it is before actual veteran cops come by and pound on you with truncheons on the kidneys to show, why can't I do it? I'm just having a beer. What? I don't know. That's the law, though. You don't fuck around. You can't drive down the street without a seatbelt on. Why not? I don't know. You're going to put on a helmet. You can't sit in your own backyard naked, your own filthy, dirty flesh that you're born with. You know that body you carry around? Filthy. You can't sit up. Why not? I don't know. That's just the way it is. Mother! You're not free. You're not free in the least. You need a diploma in this country to cut hair. You're free? You need to keep your tray in an upright and locked position during takeoff. That's not just a hack premise. It's a fucking felony. And Cunty the Hero Sky Cunt will fucking throw you off the plane as a terrorist for going, why do I have to have this to make sense? They say if you give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day. But if you teach a man to fish, then he's going to get a fishing license, but he doesn't have any money. So he's going to get a job, and he has to get into the Social Security system and pay taxes. And now you're going to audit the poor cocksucker, because he's not really good with math. You pull the IRS van up to your house, he'll take all your shit. He'll take your Black Velvet Elvis and your Batman toothbrush and your penis pump, and that all goes up for auction with the burden of proof on you, because you forgot to carry the one, because you were just worried about eating a fucking fish, and you couldn't even cook the fish because you needed a permit for an open flame. And then the health department is going to start asking you a lot of questions about where are you going to dump the scales and the guts. This is not a sanitary environment. And ladies and gentlemen, if you get sick of it all at the end of the day, not even legal to kill yourself in this country. Thanks again, John Ashcroft, you weird Bible addict, can't even handle his own drug. You were born free, you got fucked out of half of it, and you wave a flag celebrating.
Hey, don't hold back.
You got an argument?
All right, let's get back on track. Here on episode 96 of MediaMonarchy.com, continuing to cover the combat brigades that have been assigned to NORTHCOM to patrol the homeland. So here's the latest from Wikinews. Army Sergeant asserts posse comitatus is not being violated. Wikinews recently published an article which explained that NORTHCOM, through an executive order of the President of the United States, directed the 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Brigade Combat Team to return to the United States from active duty missions in Iraq to begin training in a new role. NORTHCOM says that these troops will be used to protect the United States from threats within the United States, as well as to provide support to local and state emergencies during times of emergencies such as with Hurricane Katrina. And we know how well that worked out. Critics, however, believe that moving an active military unit back to the U.S. soil represents a violation of the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, which makes it illegal for federal military resources to act as law enforcement agencies against civilians.
The article includes cites from critic Naomi Wolf, who based part of her opinion on an interview with retired U.S. Air Force Colonel David Antoon. Retired Colonel Antoon, A-N-T-O-O-N, stated that a military coup was already underway through the actions of NORTHCOM and that other branches of the government would be powerless. Wikinews reporter Kevin Fields had an opportunity to speak with an active duty member of the United States Army, a sergeant who is currently deployed to a peacekeeping mission in Iraq. Federal laws officially prevent him from making any or from giving or making any statement on military policy. However, he agreed to do so on the condition of anonymity. So the initials here used are not his, of his name. It's a pseudonym. Sergeant PSN was asked to review the original article that all this came out of from the Army Times, which provided the original breaking information, and our unknown Army sergeant provides his opinions. And you can click there and read the rest of that exchange, where he's basically trying to make excuses for having the military on American soil. We can hit the flashback and hit the two of those. NORTHCOM denies troops to be used for crowd control. Again, that was their backpedaling that began. And initially, the original article, helping people at home may become permanent part of active Army. Now, we hit last week, Glenn Beck, running his mouth out of both sides, as they all do. But he was basically talking about Endgame and New World Order and one world government and one financial currency. And we were basically stating how it's now so open and in your face. It's the revelation of the method. But he's still doing it again. Now he's discussing economic martial law. So Steve Watson writes, like him or loathe him, CNN's Glenn Beck became the only mainstream media source. What does that say? Thus far, to address on national TV the reality of the situation Americans are facing with the manufactured financial implosion, the direct threat of domestic martial law, and a global financial dictatorship.
I have a lot of people who talk to me offline, if you will. They'll tell me things that they won't tell anybody else because of their position, or you know, they don't want to seem crazy or whatever. I got a call from a friend of mine who is very high placed. He said, everybody I know, Glenn, is reading about the Weimar Republic. And I said, oh, geez, the loaf of bread with a wheelbarrow full of money republic? He said, mm-hmm. It is what a lot of people believe is coming. Try to buy a book online about the Weimar Republic. You will have a hard time finding some of the books. A lot of them are just suddenly gone. Who's reading them all, and why now? Peter Schiff, president of EuroPac and author of the little book of bull moves and bear markets. Peter, worst nightmare looks like it's coming true, because you know, as much as anybody wants to say that we're borrowing this money, we are borrowing some of this money, but people are also asking for insurance, if you will, on our treasuries, which has never ever happened before. We need credit default swaps on our treasuries now to make sure that, because some people are saying, I don't know if they're good for the money. We're printing a lot of this money, aren't we?
Well, I think that's where it's going to come from. Remember, credit comes from savings. And we blew through most of our savings when the dot-com bubble crashed. And then we started borrowing a lot of money from the rest of the world. Wall Street helped us do this with these structured products where we tapped into the global savings glut. And we borrowed from China and Saudi Arabia and Russia and Japan. But now we can't pay the money back. And nobody wants to lend us any more. So they're trying to recreate it with a printing press. And that's exactly what happened in Weimar Republic, Germany. That's what's happening in Zimbabwe right now.
When you have inflation, let's just say that unemployment next year, next summer, is maybe 10%, and you inflation at what? What do you project next year, just by the amount of money that we put into the market?
Well, I think it's already running a little bit north of 10%. I think pretty soon, maybe a year or two down the line, it's going to be going at least 20 or 30%
for inflation.
Year. The government won't admit it, but it will be.
Right. But they won't admit it, but we'll feel it. When inflation is 20%, you have unemployment at at least 10%. What happens then? People can't pay their bills. They can't pay their mortgages. They can't pay their credit card. I mean, the whole thing starts to fall.
Well, they already can't pay their bills.
I know.
And the government, see, instead of encouraging us to start saving now so we can pay back the debt, they're trying to encourage us to borrow even more money and spend that. You know, what's going to happen, of course, is as inflation starts running out of control and prices start going through the roof, the government, again, is going to focus on the symptoms and not the disease, yeah. And they're going to impose price controls on energy, on food, on a lot of other things that are vital, which means shortages, which means long lines, black markets, civil unrest. All this stuff is coming if we don't stop.
Okay, Peter, Let me be just a conspiracy guy here for just a second, because what drives me crazy is all these people are so very smart. They know. I mean, you know, I get a call from somebody who is in the know, and he says everybody's reading about this. Everybody is aware. And this is a guy at the highest level of global banking. I mean, are we being pushed into a global one financial system? What is happening?
I don't know what's going to happen as far as a global currency, but if you remember the Weimar Republic, they were in trouble because of the reparations from the Treaty of Versailles.
They had huge external liabilities. If I may take you back one step, they got into a war and decided they didn't want to finance it with taxes or finance it with bonds. They just decided to run a deficit. That was the first step.
Right. That sounds very familiar. Yeah. That's what we're doing with Iraq.
Glenn Beck again discussing economic martial law. Blasting forward, my friends, I think the comic strip was good, but the videos may be even better. They're beautifully done and devastatingly satiric. Or is it satirical? Get your war on. How to get on the Homeland Security list.
Accounts receivable.
Hey.
What are you working on?
I don't know. Accounts receivable type stuff.
Hey, did you hear they've got more than 1 million names on the terrorist watch list?
1 million names?
Yeah, that's what I heard.
How are we going to fight 1 million terrorists?
Don't worry. A lot of people on the terrorist watch list aren't even terrorists.
Oh, that's good. Why are they on the list?
You know, it's stuff like human error, data entry kerfuffles, that kind of stuff.
America loves a list.
You know, if I was a hardcore terrorist who was killing people like crazy and blowing shit up trying to get on that list, I'd probably resent the folks who got on the list just because some
doofus on Homeland Security made a data
entry error. Honestly, I think I would take umbrage.
Yeah, you would take umbrage.
I would take umbrage. I mean, look, it's like I'm a straight-up terrorist. I'm a madman with a scraggledy-ass beard and blood on my hand.
I've heard this. Don't stick me on the same list as some mild-mannered podiatrist
from Sioux Falls who's only on it because he's got too many hyphens in his name. Put me on a better list.
A better list?
Yeah, that list should be for terrorists with sterling transcripts.
You want tougher admission standards, huh?
I'm saying get me on the list and quit fucking around with this bullshit.
It's the whole PC mentality. I mean, who do I have
to kill to get on the real list?
I think you're probably on that list now.
No. Look, I'm just saying if I was a terrorist, that's how I'd feel.
And I'm saying you're on the list now.
What?
You're on the phone right now saying I'm a terrorist.
Fuck me. God damn it. To all the real terrorists out there, I say I'm sorry for getting all up in your list. I don't want to be here any
more than you want me to, so, you know.
Please don't kill me or my family.
Getting all up in your list, get your war on, how to get on the Homeland Security terror list. A lot of new news. And again, as we approach the 45th anniversary of the coup d'etat known as the assassination of JFK, one of the big things in the last week, new JFK tapes released. So originally from WHDH, as well as MSNBC and NBC and all the others, newly discovered audio tapes provide a look inside the life of John F. Kennedy, just as he was getting his 1960 presidential campaign started. The audio was recorded at a dinner party at the Kennedy home in Georgetown. Two journalists asked the young senator about his life, health, and politics. The tapes were recorded just over 3 months before Kennedy's assassination in 1963. Now, as an astute commenter on MediaMonarchy.com pointed out, which is it, and I haven't dug enough into this to see, they say that they're tapes when he just started to get his 1960 presidential campaign started, and then it says it was made just 3 months before he was assassinated. Now, I don't think Brian Williams gets into that, but here he is anyway.
The JFK tapes, conversations with John F. Kennedy. And if you're joining us for this feature on our website, this instantly tells us something about you, that you're as interested in this and engaged in this and as curious about this new material as we were. I'm joined by NBC News presidential historian and noted author Michael Beschloss. And Michael, it's tough to set the scene. There's so many different ways. There's geography. This is happening in the Kennedy's Georgetown townhouse. And there's the time of year and what's going on in his life. So have at it.
Well, 3 days before, he had announced for the presidency of the United States. So he is sitting there thinking about, am I going to win? What is my life going to be like? And he's also thinking, if I lose this presidential race, I'll probably have to get out of the Senate at the end of my term. The end of his term, he would have been 46 years old. So he's thinking, what will I do with my life if I have to change careers at the age of 46? Poignantly, of course, he was 46 ultimately when he was assassinated as president.
He talks about his political life starting. He was at loose ends, as he put it. Talks about how World War II displaced a lot of men. They were flung around the earth. A lot of them had trouble when they came back. Some just put their heads down and went to work. He talks about having been tempted to become a writer at Fortune Magazine. Can you imagine the byline, John F. Kennedy?
John F. Kennedy at Fortune Magazine, I think it would have been a little bit of an underuse of his talents, don't you think?
Unbelievable. And then it was a speech he gave in Boston that was so well received. The crowd, the response to it was electric, and he learns this kid, Joseph P. Kennedy's son, who wasn't supposed to be the politician in the family, he learns maybe I wouldn't be half bad at this, and starts collecting names in a notebook.
This curiously suggests to me that the only reason you want to be president is because you're dissatisfied with the limits of your power in the Senate.
No, but the point is that all the things that you're interested in, I mean, I'm interested in a number of things, presidency, the president can do them, and the Senate cannot do them. There's much less than meets the eye in the Senate, in my opinion. You don't think Lyndon Johnson is the second most powerful man that I see. And he's well down the range. He has a veto power, but that's all. Now, how could you possibly say that you're interested, that you must be, if you're in the Senate, going to do all that? And then say that you wouldn't want to be president, which is the source of action.
Well, it's inherent in every politician.
Well, everybody. I mean, would you like to be head of the Washington Bureau, or would you like to be editor of Newsweek? Trying to separate a normal desire to move ahead, which I think everybody, my God, how would you possibly, how would the world move without that motion in everybody?
And yet it's true that there are only some people that have either what it takes or something in them that makes them go through.
I know. Everybody reaches a natural level. It's possible my natural level in the Senate. I mean, in the next 6 months. But there isn't anybody in the House that would not like to advance themselves. I mean, anybody who works for anything. My God, if you didn't have that power of desire, the United States and every place else would collapse. That's what moves the country and the world.
That's just a couple minutes from what's about a 20-minute piece, and you can listen to a lot of those recordings. One of them's called JFK Unplugged, and there's another video, The Rewards of Politics Are Infinite. And again, all those videos are up. They kind of get, I believe, squashed on YouTube because they're NBC, so they're putting them up on Hulu, which is their site. But anyway, let's jump to filmstew.com for JFK's Other World. Perhaps the strangest thing about the new documentary, At the Center of the World, Hyannisport and the Presidency of JFK, which premiered to a standing ovation in Cape Cod, involves the credentials of its director, Andrew Fone, F-O-N-E. Because the man responsible for this celebration of how important JFK's summer White House was to his brief presidential reign is a producer with Fox News in Boston. Talk about moonlighting for the other team. Senator Edward Kennedy was originally scheduled to attend the October 3rd premiere at the Hyannisport Club, which benefited the John F. Kennedy Hyannis Museum Foundation, but due to his recent battles with brain cancer, he was present on screen only in the form of many warm-hearted recollections about his older brother. As an indication of just how much things have changed, Kennedy aide David Crawford, per a report in the Cape Cod Times with a link for you, recalls, for example, in the film how JFK, while awaiting the final results of the 1960 presidential election, relaxed by passing around a football with staff and Secret Service men. And sure enough, Kennedy spent many a weekend, morning or afternoon, sailing his own Wiano Sr., named the Victura. Andrew Fone's feature-length documentary also touches on the ease with which JFK befriended children, giving them rides in his golf cart, buying them penny candy at the village's news shop or skipping stones, and having floating seashell contests with them.
But getting more sinister, if we jump to the Longview News Journal, this coming out of Dallas, Texas, or there nearby. Man grazed by JFK bullet spreading the gospel of cover-up. In the hours after JFK was assassinated, James T. Tague, T-A-G-U-E, went down to the Dallas police station to give a statement of what he'd seen. Speaking last Tuesday night to a group of about 20 people at the Longview Public Library, Tague once again recounted the afternoon. Late for a date, he had gotten out of his car to find out why traffic had stopped. He soon realized it was because of the president's motorcade. As Tague watched the procession make its way down the street, he heard what sounded like a firecracker go off, fired by rifle shots. The next thing he knew, a man standing on the grassy knoll nearby yelled out, "His head exploded! His head exploded!" Kennedy had been shot. Caught up in the commotion, it took Tague a moment to realize that his face had been grazed by shrapnel after a bullet struck the curb near where he was standing. Like many other witnesses, Tague was drawn into the initial investigation, asked by officials to recount what he had seen. Nearly 45 years later now, Tague continues to tell audiences of his observations and about the cover-up he believes the government was in on. Saying, quote, "Kennedy was murdered by our own government. They wanted Johnson in the White House. Everyone around Johnson wanted him." Tague's interest in the 1963 shooting led him to evidence that he says points to the government's involvement in the assassination. After years of digging, he has completed his book, Truth Withheld. "The story needs to be told," Tague said, and although he admits that nobody will ever know the exact truth about what happened, and there are a number of details that he said he isn't sure about, how many shooters there were, for instance, but he is positive of one thing, and so am I, that, quote, "This is a complete cover-up of a coup d'etat." If we jump now to moviesblog.mtv.com, it's bizarre that this article comes from there, but it's the only place I found anything about it. Ready for another JFK conspiracy movie? Here comes Dorothy Kilgallen. Mulder and Scully may be in semi-retirement these days, but that doesn't mean conspiracy theories are dead. Producer John Davis has optioned Paul Alexander's soon-to-be-published book, Goodnight, Dorothy Kilgallen, and that's K-I-L-G-A-L-L-E-N. And it's an expose tying the death of journalist Kilgallen to her investigation of JFK's assassination. Kilgallen considered Kennedy a friend and was obsessed with investigating the circumstances of his death. She became convinced his assassination was part of a conspiracy and was determined to prove it. She managed to obtain enough evidence and interviews, including the only one with Jack Ruby, the man who shot Lee Harvey Oswald, that the FBI kept her under close surveillance. Alexander's book alleges that Kilgallen was murdered after finishing her book, Murder One, and that all its chapters about JFK disappeared. Her death was certainly under mysterious circumstances, and many have argued that she simply knew too much. She was certainly a female Fox Mulder. In addition to investigating Kennedy's death, she also alleged that the government had covered up the existence of UFOs. Davis, producer John Davis, bring the project to Fox, home of the X-Files, appropriate, and has set screenwriter Shane Salerno to pen the script. The movie will be a fictionalized conspiracy story, but this is definitely a story where the truth is stranger than fiction. I remember first reading about Dorothy Kilgallen in a short-run magazine-style comic book from Paradox Press, I think under DC and Vertigo years ago, and it was called Weird, and the very first issue was all about presidential conspiracies, and there was a strip in there about Dorothy Kilgallen, and that she had basically said she'd made a lot of progress on the case and was all excited about it, and then they found her overdosed, laying in bed, supposedly reading a book, and the book placed on her belly as she laid there and died in bed. Friends had said, she already read that book. We talked about it a bunch. We both read it. That she wouldn't have been rereading that book, that she was placed in bed and overdosed with some pills, and they threw a book on it. Dorothy Kilgallen, coming soon. Another one, and the final one in JFK assassination news, this from the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Hopefully we'll see a bunch of video come out from this. I haven't just yet, but there was a three-day forum in Pittsburgh exploring the big three assassinations. 4 decades later, the assassinations of JFK, RFK, and MLK will be dissected at Duquesne University, It was a symposium for 3 days called Making Sense of the 60s, and you can link to the original site. And it was hosted by the Cyril H. Wecht Institute of Forensic Science and Law. Cyril Wecht has done a lot of medical work in the JFK case. Again, you should always check out blackopradio.com for a lot of great interviews. It's a pretty weighty thing for people to confront, said Isaac Ferris Jr., MLK's nephew and CEO of the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change in Atlanta. Who knows how their deaths impacted our trajectory? Who knows where our nation might have been? My God, we wiped out three of the greatest leaders of a generation. Let's move back and cozy on down in Police State USA. Spies, lies, pain rays, and credible threats. First from Raw Story. And this is one we've already covered a bit, and we will cover more so as James Bamford's book is now out, The Shadow Factory. And of course, there's going to be the PBS tie-in show. And it all relates, again, how we covered that the NSA was listening to everything, and they would trade the messages. Oh, you got to listen to this one. There's some good phone sex. But anyway, this from Raw Story. NSA revelations to have lasting implications following the actually not all that surprising bombshell that the National Security Agency has been eavesdropping on calls between innocent U.S. citizens. Activists are considering reopening a lawsuit alleging the government's infringement upon constitutional rights. An appeals court last year dismissed a lawsuit brought by the ACLU against the NSA, arguing the plaintiffs the ACLU represented could not prove they had been targets of warrantless surveillance the NSA had engaged in. Now that ABC News has revealed evidence of NSA spooks listening to innocent Americans' private phone calls, the civil liberties group may ask the court to reconsider. Everything is being discussed right now, ACLU attorney Jamil Jaffer told Raw Story last week. So tying nicely in with this, and this is just the one clip that I have posted up. I think I have some others bookmarked, so we'll get into them in the next little bit. But again, it's James Bamford and his new book, The Shadow Factory.
Evidence the government has been spying on personal calls and passing around phone sex audio is just one of the many scary bombshells in the new book, The Shadow Factory, which comes out on Tuesday. The author is investigative journalist James Bamford. He's been covering the NSA for 25 years, and he joins us now. Mr. Bamford, many thanks for joining us. Congratulations on the new book.
No, thanks, Rachel. I appreciate it.
If the point is to gather valuable intelligence on terrorists, isn't it counterproductive to sit around listening to soldiers talk to their wives and girlfriends?
Well, that was one of the complaints they had, and I think one of the things that drove them to become whistleblowers was because both of them protested, both internally, and Adrian, the woman who was doing the intercepting, protested to Senator Leahy on the Intelligence Committee and got nowhere. Nobody even went back to her to ask her about these things. So they were very angry that they were eavesdropping on average Americans instead of going after terrorists, which is what they went into the military to do in the first place.
Why were these calls listened to at all? What was the strategy here? Was it a vacuum up everything strategy?
Well, that was it. It's a vacuum up everything. And then they had an option of getting rid of the calls that weren't very, very useful. The calls to journalists, the calls to aid workers, pillow talk between the soldiers and their spouses back in the U.S. But they were told that they can't eliminate those telephone calls from the incoming mix. They had to keep them there. And so every time a person called their spouse or every time a journalist called his source or called the editor or called his wife or husband, they were called, and they were collected and then transcribed and also stored. The NSA is building an enormous facility in Texas to store all these conversations.
Is it clear to you that this program is illegal?
Well, it seems like it's illegal. The problem is that the Congress changed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act so much, it's hard to tell what's legal and what isn't legal. But at the very beginning stages of this, you had the Deputy Attorney General, the Attorney General, the FBI Director, and numerous other officials literally within days of quitting because they thought this program was so illegal.
James Bamford, author of the new book, The Shadow Factory, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I have to tell you, I can't put the book down.
Thanks, Rachel. I appreciate it.
James Bamford does good work. He's a little too limited hangout for me sometimes, though. And again, we'll be getting more into the revelations as we all dig through the Shadow Factory. Something that goes along with this, an article up on Danger Room. And the operation has a name. Operation Highlander was the name of the NSA's wiretapping of Americans abroad. So you can hit that. But tying into all this, and again, we're discussing police state USA, spies, lies, pain rays, and credible threats. Again, financial, New World Order, the combat brigades, it all ties in. And James Corbett, the hard worker behind CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com, has put together a good video. We'll listen to a couple minutes. U.S. Army prepares to invade the U.S.
During debates on the banker bailout bill on the floor of Congress last week, Congressman Brad Sherman made a startling revelation.
Many of us were told in private conversations that if we voted against this bill on Monday, that the sky would fall, the market would drop 2,000 or 3,000 points first day, another couple thousand the second day, and a few members were even told that there would be martial law in America if we voted no.
Martial law is defined as the rule by military authorities imposed on a civilian population. According to an article in the Army Times last month, the administration's threats of implementing martial law is not idle talk. In this shocking article, the U.S. Army admits that bringing a combat team back from Iraq to continue their mission in America, and that this combat team will be assigned to NORTHCOM to assist in the event of civil unrest in crowd control through non-lethal weaponry. This deployment is, of course, in direct violation of long-standing laws known as Posse Comitatus and the Insurrection Act, which strictly prohibit the U.S. Army from policing American citizens on American soil. While such extraordinary steps toward the open implementation of martial law on the streets of America might seem like the Bush administration's last-ditch effort to keep the public in check while they rob the Treasury of hundreds of billions for their banker friends, it is crucial to understand that this is only the final stage in a careful plan that has been unfolding for decades through both Republican and Democrat administrations. Government plans to suspend the Constitution and effect martial law have been taking place behind the scenes under continuity of government contingencies, first exposed in the mid-1980s and raised by Congressman Jack Brooks during the Iran-Contra hearings.
Colonel North, in your work at the NSC, were you not assigned at one time to work on plans for the continuity of government in the event of a major disaster?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that question touches upon a highly sensitive and classified area, so may I request that you not touch upon that, sir.
I was particularly concerned, Mr. Chairman, because I read in Miami papers and several others that there had been a plan developed by that same agency, a contingency plan in the event of emergency that would suspend the American Constitution. And I was deeply concerned about it and wondered if that was the area in which he had worked.
I most respectfully request that that matter not be touched upon at this stage. If we wish to get into this, uncertain arrangements can be made for an executive session.
Now, we've heard that clip before, but it's always important to hit it again and again. The part there at the end with Jack Brooks asking about the classified continuity of government plans during the Iran-Contra hearings, tied up with Oliver North and called REX 84, Readiness Exercise 84, also ties in with something called Operation Garden Plot, and it basically all ties in with FEMA and continuity of government. And again, that video, U.S. Army Prepares to Invade the U.S., is from James Corbett at thecorbettreport.com. There's another one up on opednews.com, The Martial Law Hypothesis, A Closer Look and Some Skepticism. Again, they basically walk through the financial meltdown, the combat brigades, the election, and all the things that swirl around in this perfect storm. Still within the police state parameters, but more on the Enviro tip, green is the new red. This is the New York Times pint-sized eco-police making parents proud and crazy. Sometimes Jennifer Ross feels she can't make a move at home without inviting the scorn of her daughters, 10-year-old Grace and 7-year-old Eliza. The Acura MDX she drives, a flagrant polluter. The bath at night to help her relax, a wasteful indulgence. The reusable shopping bag she forgot again, tisk tisk. I have very environmentally conscious children, more so than me, I'm embarrassed to say, said Miss Ross, a social worker in Dobbs Ferry, New York. They're on my case about getting a hybrid car. They want me to replace all the light bulbs in the house with energy-saving bulbs. Mrs. Ross's children are part of what experts say is a growing army of eco-kids, steeped in environmentalism at schools, in houses of worship, through scouting, and even via popular culture, who try to hold their parents accountable at home. Amid their pride and their children's zeal for all things green, the grown-ups sometimes end up feeling like scofflaws under the watchful eye of the pint-sized eco-police whose demands grow ever greater and greater and more expensive. And it's just the beginning. But shifting gears, let's learn about something called a drop gun. As we ask the question, are drop guns coming to America? So, in this clip, former U.S. soldiers explain how they were told to carry drop guns to cover up the murder of Iraqi citizens. According to the soldiers, this is an informal military policy.
It was one of those things that's like recommended to you on the side, where it's like, you know, if I were a smart Marine, I would, I'd have an AK or something in my vehicle just in case, you know, somebody accidentally gets killed, you know, I wouldn't get in trouble for it because, oh, well, it's obviously an insurgent. He has a weapon. So you're in the clear because you killed an insurgent.
When we arrived there, he gave us quite a few AKs, and he said, keep them in case something happens. And that was about it. It just went from chain of command down to us, and actually it was pretty much everybody on the base.
When mistakes were made, we carried drop weapons. These weapons right here were taken from the Iraqi police back during our first deployment. And this is just an example that we would take their weapons and carry them around with us in case we did mess up and shot the wrong person.
I've heard numerous circumstances of civilians getting killed and then, you know, soldiers and Marines subsequently placing weapons on their bodies or placing wire on them.
We would photograph all the people we killed, and in the photographs there would be the object, either the shoulder, the AK-47. And that was proof enough to protect the individual soldiers from getting tried for any sort of crimes.
We hear of very few of the prosecutions that actually occur in Iraq and Afghanistan. But of those that have made the newspapers, I can think three off the top of my head, which involved a dropped weapon. So yes, it does happen, and it happens more frequently than we would like to believe, and certainly more frequently than we know.
So, as the combat brigades have been assigned to America, are they going to bring their practices? They're going to bring them here. So they're going to bring drop guns, and that leads us to the next one from Danger Room. Army orders pain ray trucks as a new report shows that they have a, quote, potential for death. After years of testing, the Active Denial System, ADS, the pain ray which drives off rioters with a microwave-like beam, could finally have its day. The Army is buying 5 of the truck-mounted systems for $25 million, but the energy weapon may face new hurdles before it's shipped off to the battlefield. A new report details how the supposedly non-lethal blaster could be turned into a flesh-frying killer. Jumping down a little bit, the announcement arrives on the same day as a new report from less lethal weapons expert Dr. Jürgen Altman that analyzes the physics of several directed energy weapons, DEW, including active denial, the advanced tactical laser, which we've covered and will cover again soon, used as a non-lethal weapon, the pulsed energy projectile, a.k.a. maximum pain laser, and the long-range acoustic device, a.k.a. acoustic blaster, a.k.a. LRAD. And so a quote from the report says, as a consequence, the ADS provides the technical possibility to produce burns of second and third degree. And it gets worse. And you can download the report and all the links are in there for you. But let's jump to U.S. News and World Report. Credible threat at Middle Tennessee State. Again, keeping an eye on the bizarre shooter drills and shooter activity at schools. Middle Tennessee State University was shut down last Thursday around noon after authorities determined that there was a, quote, credible threat to campus. The announcement was made after multiple university officials received emails Wednesday and Thursday threatening the student body, and authorities responded to three suspicious small fires set in a dorm. According to the campus police chief, at least one of the emails references killing, bombing, and destruction, but does not specify location. Authorities are still unsure whether the fires and the threats are related. Classes were canceled for the rest of the week as state and local police sweep the campus with their weapons drawn, according to the Tennessean, looking for a male suspect, which I believe, if you hit that link to the Tennessean, they have one. Officials did not reveal why he was being sought. MTSU is one of the largest undergrad colleges in Tennessee with almost 24,000 students, most of whom live off campus. So classes restarted on October 15th after a previously scheduled fall break. So again, the suspicious one in me says, oh, so what were they doing while everybody was out of there, cleared out? And the thugs in the black uniforms were skulking about. But let's jump to the Orange County Register. Sheriff begins taking away concealed weapons permits. The Sheriff's Department has begun the process of revoking hundreds of concealed weapon permits across Orange County. This week, department officials confirmed that 146 letters have been sent out advising current license holders that their permits to carry firearms in public, called CCWs, are being revoked. There are currently 1,024 permit holders, I guess, in Orange County, California. Quote, the department has determined that your identified risk does not meet the good cause threshold as required under the new CCW policy based upon the information you provided. As a result of this determination, the department's present intention is to revoke your CCW license, reads the form letter sent out this month. And so again, they say it's a policy. A policy is not a law. And the comment from, I believe, Aaron Dykes, it's clear that the intention is to demonize gun ownership while making the permit aspect convey a privilege rather than a right as guarded by the Second Amendment of the Constitution. Further, the claim that the former sheriff was corrupt, which it gets into in the article from the Register, is meant to justify the revoking of permits, which are also associated emotionally as being wrong to hold. So there's lots of language, and of course there's lots of selective enforcement. But let's get out of the police state, USA, and get into the movie theater. I'm not sure if I'll have time to check this out either today or tomorrow, but I, for the most part, have been a big Oliver Stone fan. JFK is definitely one of my favorite films. It's such an amazing package on a bunch of different levels, and I won't go into JFK. But Wall Street and Talk Radio and Natural Born Killers and Platoon and all those. He even wrote Scarface, if you recall. But when he made World Trade Center and made Alexander and that whole era, I was kind of done. Now, I've definitely been interested and excited to see W. The reviews are meh. But we have a bunch. Not all of them. I stopped at some point. But we're going to hit up first Raw Replay. And we've also got Washington Post and AP and McClatchy and CBS and more. But it's all under the heading, W Film Aimed at Independent Voters. CNN's Karine Winter reported that Oliver Stone's new film, W, is aimed at independent voters and timed to affect the election. And just within that, you can hit up a couple Reuters and LA Times clips. So I put them all together. There's clips with CBS and AP and other interviews, I believe, again, from Rachel Maddow. So let's listen to a little bit of Oliver Stone talk about his new film, W.
This political film is being released right before the election, with some wondering, could it actually influence voters?
John, I'm sure historians will say, gosh, you know, I wish he could have done better.
It's Oliver Stone's latest presidential biopic, W, recounting the film depicts as the current president's booze-soaked youth to a scathing indictment of his time in office. The film is anything but flattering to President Bush.
I want Americans to see that this character, who they voted for, a little bit better, understand why we voted for him, what it is he's done, and where we are now.
Who do you think you are? Kennedy? You're a Bush. Act like one.
Stephen J. Ross, professor of film and politics at USC, says Jones' decision to release the film just 18 days before the presidential election was no accident.
It is the impact that he wants to have right now. And he's really aiming, I think, not at the Democrats, not at the Republicans, but at those independents, that 20% that both sides are still battling for.
Ross says even those who choose not to buy a ticket could still be influenced, from posters and billboards that read "A Life Misunderestimated" to TV spots and websites with the slogan "Anyone can grow up to be president." But Ross says this kind of disparaging marketing could flop.
There are people who are going to see Oliver Stone's film as an example of negative campaigning, of a character smear against a outgoing president, and Oliver Stone is a filmmaker who often crosses the line, like Michael Moore. As a political strategy, it actually backfires.
Moore's 2004 movie, Fahrenheit 9/11, slammed the current administration and was a box office hit, but it failed to keep Mr. Bush from winning a second term.
This is for all those who doubted I won the election.
Whether it's seen as a character assassination or art imitating life, W, like most of Stone's films, will probably leave audiences loving or hating it. When we asked the White House about this film, they had no comment.
As far as I understand it, you were in the same freshman class at Yale as George W. Bush.
I didn't make it, though. I didn't finish.
Well, your paths diverted famously. I mean, you ended up going to Vietnam. He very famously did not end up going to Vietnam. In some ways, when you look at the films, the historical films that you have made, do you feel like you're sort of an archaeologist of your own era, of your own lifetime, that you are telling your own life story through the cultural and political touchstones of your time?
You know, what else can I do? That's my minor contribution, is to go through my life and respond the way I do, viscerally and emotionally and somewhat intellectually, to the issues of my time, Vietnam and the Kennedy assassination. It's what else do I know? You know, yeah. I do know Vietnam, and I have a sense of these presidencies. This has been an extremely difficult 8 years for me and many Vietnam veterans, because I had three movies about Vietnam, and none of them worked in the sense of stopping us from repeating very much a similar pattern in Iraq.
Mm. Well, I will say that I was born in 1973. Platoon came out in 1987?
Six.
1986. So I was 13 when it came out, and it was formative for me in terms of understanding what shaped world that I'd been born into. So it's not just your life, it's the American life.
I really believe in America. I love it. I love the sense of initiative and freedom, and at the same time, I just wish we sometimes were a little bit more conscious about what we're doing, and I think we made a vast mistake in the last 8 years. I really do. But I think, I pray that with Mr. Obama, or whoever wins, Obama or McKinney, going to have a hell of a hard time changing the direction of where we are. We have still a preemptive policy in place, which declares basically that we are the dominant military presence in the world, economic, and we will take on any rival that emerges. That's
even a preventive war, to prevent rivals.
There's no way we can afford to with this present situation. I think the economy will speak for us, and you know, everyone's in such bad news, but you know, it might lead to some belt tightening and perhaps some restraint in foreign policy.
Changing of our horizons and what we think can accomplish. One last question on that. I imagine that it is no coincidence that you made this film very quickly and that it's got a release date before the election. You are hoping this is on people's minds as they vote?
You know, I did three movies about Vietnam. It didn't do much good. So what can you say? You don't do a movie for that reason. Short term, I'm making a movie for 20 years. I'm more worried about what's going to happen in 2020, 2040, and who are we going to elect next?
Hmm. Well, it's a thin and fuzzy line between changing the world and changing people's minds. Oliver Stone, it's
Thank
a real pleasure
much.
To have you here. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
You view this president as fill in the blank.
Well, I'm not the judge. I'm the dramatist. I'm putting out this story. It's one of the most incredible stories of the last 20 years. This guy, who was an improbable president, came from very strange roots, and
He's shaped and changed the world in these last 8 years in ways that were inconceivable. I mean, so he spoke for himself, the administration, but it's not for me to. You see the movie, and you walk out and think about where we are now as a country, where we were 8 years ago, and I think you come up to your own conclusion.
People, I was in a screening of this movie just yesterday. This person was walking out with this, my gosh, it seems so sympathetic. I didn't feel that way, but you're hearing that yourself, I'm sure.
I hear it, but I think there's a confusion between sympathy and empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Empathy means understanding, and as a dramatist, it's my job to understand, to walk in the shoes of George W. Bush best as I can.
Right.
Sympathize, no. I do think he's hurt this country. I'm a Vietnam veteran. We should not have gone into the Iraq War. We're in three wars, not only Afghanistan and Iraq, but really the war on terror is a major war. You know, we've had an economic meltdown, and because of it, partly because of the overreach. And this country is in a very dire place, and I'm not happy about it.
All those clips are up in their entirety up on MediaMonarchy.com, so let's just dig through the quick mixed bag of reviews of Oliver Stone's W. So, first from the Washington Post, I think it's their Anne Hornaday lead movie critic there, a puzzling portrayal of a president. W, the title of Oliver Stone's new biopic of President Bush, obviously refers to the subject's middle initial and nickname, but it could just as easily stand for Y. Why this movie? A rushed, wildly uneven, tonally off-kilter caricature, and why now? Why, when Americans and citizens around the globe are still coping with myriad depredations of the Bush administration policies, would they want to pay money at the box office to see what amounts to an extended Saturday Night Live skit? The Associated Press has Stone's balanced W is no JFK. All he wanted to do was watch baseball and drink beer. Instead, George W. Bush ended up being chosen as leader of the free world. That's Oliver Stone's surprisingly fair and balanced assessment of the president, who truly needs no further parroting. In W., Stone, who previously dug up the White House dirt with the conspiracy-laden JFK and the campy and paranoid Nixon, has come up with a rather conventional biopic rather than an evisceration. So, from McClatchy, October surprise, Oliver Stone's W doesn't have one. Watching W, you get a sense of the scrupulous care and respect with which director Oliver Stone and screenwriter Stanley Weiser, W-E-I-S-E-R, approach their movie about the troubled presidency of Bush. This is, for Stone, an unusually restrained and well-behaved film, one that's going to confound viewers expecting a free-for-all demonization of 43. What you don't get while watching W is a convincing argument that the movie needed to be made. And again, the video of Oliver Stone talking to Harry Smith on CBS. We can hit up Market Watch. How unpopular is W? Oliver Stone's W will tell us. So this week, Lionsgate will go a long way toward tapping the nation's mood. On October 17th, that's today, the film studio will release the long-awaited movie W, director Oliver Stone's look at President Bush. It will open on about 1,800 screens across America. The film is informally projected to amass ticket sales of about 10 mil, but I suspect it will do better in its initial weekend. The movie debuts at an opportune time to measure the president's relevance. Bush's approval ratings have sunk to near historic lows. His somber proclamations on the financial meltdown and foreign policy issues have largely been ignored. Sarah Palin's emergence in the 2008 presidential campaign has all but pushed Bush off the prime areas of the front page. And I believe I have bookmarked but not posted up. Forget if it's from the Telegraph or where, but that basically Bush is, quote, relieved his presidency is almost over. You and me both, buddy. So finally there from Raw Replay, bringing us the Rachel Maddow clip from MSNBC, where Oliver Stone points out that we've made a vast mistake in the last 8 years. And that's where I believe I'm going to just about leave it for you, my friends, here on episode 96 of MediaMonarchy.com. So it's October 17th, 2008. Let's glance real quick to some of the Google News stories that are blazing right now that I haven't posted yet. McCain Palin playing defense in the race's dwindling days. That's from CNN. But also from Bloomberg and CNN and Fox and more. Iran and Iceland fail to win UN Security Council seats. Iran, a country under UN sanctions, and Iceland, which has been battered by the recent credit crisis, failed Friday to win seats on the powerful UN Security Council. And there are stories of basically empty grocery stores, and chaos emerging in Iceland. But it'll be coming here soon enough, don't you worry. Because the two puppets vying for your vote don't control the economy, and it ain't going to make a goddamn bit of difference. So whether it's Kissinger's McCain or Brzezinski's Obama, the banksters will still win. It's just a matter of which one will be able to get the ball further down the field. But we've been all over that, so I won't get into it now here at the end. Here at the end, we got to look at the visitors, the creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week. Always a funny, interesting list. So first, Ford Motor Company out of Detroit, Michigan. They Googled, and we're reading about an article we don't have time to get to right here. We'll hit it on the B-side. Portland cops test license plate cameras that store and trace data. And that is an article coming from our own Portland Tribune. It was blazing on the front page. And I believe their smaller headline was, "They will track everything," or "You will be tracked," or something sinister like that. But out of the UK, the Medical Research Council, we're reading about vaccine-linked polio hits Nigeria. That's going back a few months. The BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation out of London, we're reading about US-friendly fire killing three UK soldiers. The Woodfin Suites Hotels in Dublin, Ohio, Googled autism and BPA. Volvo Group North America out of Radford, Virginia, we're reading about those three recent 9/11 documentaries, Save the Brave, The Elephant in the Room, and Fabled Enemies. We also had Lockheed Martin out of Orinda, California. They Googled military corruption, and boy, did they find it. We also had the U.S. Information Army headquarters out of Lexington Park, Maryland, and they Googled Jamie Goodpaster. And I Googled that to see exactly what they were looking at, and now I forget. So you'll have to Google Jamie Goodpaster. It's a spokeswoman for something, I forget. But we also had the Center for Information Services out of D.C. hitting me up from whatreallyhappened.com, reading about Barry Jennings. We had NASA out of Pasadena, California, Google ICE, illegal immigrants, Iowa, which, of course, we hit that FEMA drill several months ago. They set up a FEMA drill in advance, and we all said, hey, FEMA's gearing up for something. Boom, massive raid at an Iowa plant. Telegraphing their moves, again, as they set it all up. Cedars-Sinai out of Los Angeles Googled cremation for Karthik Rajaram family. And that was the guy who basically went on a family murder-suicide spree in L.A. last week related to the financial meltdown. Cornell School District out of Coraopolis, PA Googled autism linked to BPA. My old alma mater, Shepherd University out of West Virginia. For some reason, their internet traffic routed through Malston, Wisconsin. For some reason, they Googled public radio, Obama interview, Martinsburg. United States Center for Disease Creation, Control, out of Atlanta. They were reading about the Bradford County Stages disease outbreak drill from a couple months ago. Our good friends at Goldman Sachs, engineering the financial takeover with, again, their frontman. Out of Trenton, New Jersey, reading about the Dutch royals caught revising Wikipedia. We had the Tribune Company out of Chicago Googled dummy bomb, and that was the first bit that we hit this morning about the dummy bomb falling again. Private military contractors Raytheon out of Dallas, Texas Googled NMEC Intelligence Phoenix, and we just covered that recently. And finally, the Orange County GSA Information Center out of Rancho Cucamonga, California. This is a good one. They Googled Obama and McCain beholden to CFR globalism. And yes, they are. And that's going to do it, my friends. Episode 96, October 17th, 2008. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com, bringing all the news and politics and conspiracies and cover-ups. All your news are belong to us, and we'll keep doing it. Hit me up on MediaMonarchy.com. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
diary, or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.